Hello, Daily Briefing listeners. This is Amanda Borchel-Dan. As Israel marks 6 months of war with Hamas, I offer you this conversation with public intellectual Dr. Micha Goodman from our latest episode of What Matters Now, the Times of Israel's weekly deep dive podcast exploration. As always, I'm happy to hear your thoughts at podcast@timesofisrael.com. And so now, after 6 months of war, we ask Dr. Micha Goodman, what matters now? In 6 months of war, Israel has systematically broken down Hamas's battalions in the Gaza Strip, and there are only a quarter left. But in achieving this terrible success in its aim to defang the terrorist army, the Jewish state is no longer seen on the world stage as the attacked underdog David, but is increasingly reviled as a cruel Goliath. According to many in the West, it is up to Israel to stop the war, and now, regardless of Hamas's clear ability to regroup and again attack, just as the terror group has publicly vowed to do. This week, I, Amanda Borchel-Dan, again speak with public intellectual and philosopher Dr. Micha Goodman. We revisit the raw conversation we held 6 months ago, days after Hamas's murderous attack, and see just how right Micha's predictions were. In our conversation this week, Micha explains to me the completely different framings of the war that are held by the West and held by Israel, and how they influence both sides' actions and words. And we hear how Israelis, forever changed by this war, are now standing at a crossroads. Can civil society regroup and reemerge from this war stronger, saner, and more united? Micha has spent the past 6 months writing his 7th best-selling book, Hayom Shmini, The Eighth Day, saying yes and saying that Israelis must embrace a new paradigm. So this week, 6 months to the war, we ask Dr. Micha Goodman, what matters now?
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Micha, thank you so much for letting me join you today.
Thank you, Amanda. It's nice to be here.
We are marking 6 months to the war, and you and I spoke on October 11th, a few days after the Hamas murderous onslaught that killed 1,200 and took 253 hostages into Gaza. That conversation was raw. It was powerful. And we discussed at that point, knowing that right then we were the Davids, that knowing that very soon we would be viewed as the Goliaths. And while the world supported us so deeply at that moment, we knew then and spoke about it then that it would soon turn on its axis, and it has. So in that particular conversation, you discussed what you labeled then as a zero-sum game. What did you mean by that, and how has it played out in the past 6 months?
For the past 6 months, my friends in the United States of America always telling me, Micha, Israel is ruining its reputation. You have such a bad reputation. You're losing the sympathy of the West. In the first week of October 7th, so many people loved Israel. Now they don't love Israel anymore. You're losing, you're cracking your reputation. It's all true. In week one, a lot of people loved Israel. Remember when Bono wrote a song about the music festival? Bono was singing about Israel. But we said back then that the world has a lot of sympathy for Israel when Israel is a hit. We weren't sure that the world will have sympathy for Israel when Israel hits back. And it's all true that Israel's reputation is being bruised by this war, and that's not a good thing. It's a very dangerous thing. It's not a good thing at all. But Israelis care about not one, but two reputations they need to sustain. We have a reputation in the West that we have to protect, and we have a reputation in the Middle East, which is a different reputation that we have to build, and we have to protect, and we have to sustain. And in a nutshell, we want the West to love us, and we need the Middle East to fear us. Amanda, when I say the Middle East, I don't mean our friends like the Emiratis. I mean like Beirut, Damascus, Hezbollah, Tehran. I'm talking about the jihadist forces, the Muslim Brotherhood, the jihadist forces in the Middle East. And we want two emotions. We want love and we want fear. We need the love of the West and the fear of the Middle East. But if you're an Israeli, and let's say you have to choose an emotion, what emotion will enable you to sleep better at night? Fear of the Middle East or love of the West? Which emotion?
It is better to be feared than loved.
That's what most Israelis feel. And the thing is, there might be a zero-sum game here, like we said in our conversation in week one, because everything that Israel has to do to restore the fear of the Middle East will erode the love of the West. And everything that we won't do in order to sustain, protect the love or restore the love of the West will erode the fear of the Middle East. That's a zero-sum game that we are in, but there's a catch here. The catch is that while we lose the sympathy of the West when we restore the fear of the Middle East, but the catch is that we need some sympathy of the West, some understanding of the West, in order to erode the fear of the Middle East. Because without the backing of the West, we don't have the strength that we need in order to erode. So there's a catch here. And the big question is, do we still have enough, a large enough dose of sympathy from the West after 6 months in order to finish this through and restore the fear of the Middle East? That's one of the big questions or enigmas of this moment.
Right. And as we discussed in our October 11th conversation, on October 10th, President Joe Biden delivered what you called at that point a Churchillian speech, in which he not only embraced Israel, we just felt that he was our brother. Last night, in the wake of a tragic accident in which 7 humanitarian workers from World Central Kitchen were targeted and misidentified, but targeted by the IDF, we're hearing a very different Biden.
Obviously, this is a tragedy, and wars lead to very, very bad things. And this war, it's bad. But Israelis feel radically misunderstood. I want to try to put on the table, Amanda, how we're so deeply misunderstood. And I want to put this on the table, you know, not from like what happened yesterday, but from a bird's eye view. Like Israelis say, from the bird's eye view, from a very abstract point of view. Western people, especially Americans, but Western people have a tendency to think, to organize the world using binary categories, meaning there's right and wrong, there's good and bad. And if you assume every situation, there's the right way and the wrong way, the good way and the bad way, so all you have to do is to figure out which way is bad and which way is good, and to have the courage to choose the good over the bad. That's how we think. That's how, and the world is looking at Israel. Oh, if there's only two options, the bad way and the good way, and what's happening now is bad, so the alternative, stopping the war, must be good. Binary thinking is also a childish way of thinking of things. Children divide the world into two. In a symmetric way, there's good versus bad. But Israelis are not thinking about this and experiencing this as a binary. Maybe some people in the far right think this is all good.
Or the far left think it's all bad.
It's all, yeah. But most Israelis, when I talk about most, I'm talking about like over 80%. I'm talking about tremendous numbers. They feel like We're not in a binary situation. We're in a tragic situation. Tragic situation means it's the radical acceptance of the fact that there's only bad options. It's hard to accept that. It's hard to internalize that. But when you accept, really accept, and you can't escape to some kind of a fantasy, there must be the right thing to know. There's only wrong things. There's only bad options. When you accept that, then you know two things. One, that no matter what I will do is bad, and I'll choose it because it's much better than the alternative. The alternative is worse. Why are we in a tragic situation? Because the war is bad. But why is ending the war now much, much worse? It's the bad we have to choose over the bad that we cannot choose. Why can't we choose? Because, you see, this war, on a pure military level, the Israeli military has been handling this very, very professionally. By the way, before the war began, American professionals came to Israel. It said to conquer Gaza, it will mean Israel will lose 5,000 or to 10,000 soldiers. Israel has been very, very professional in going from the north of Gaza to all the way to the south. Hamas had 24 battalions. Israel dismantled 18, 6 left, 2 in the center, Deir al-Balah, and I think Nusirat, 4 in Rafah. Once they're gone, and by the way, also their leadership, meaning they have 3 leaders left after Randour and Issa are gone, so Def and the Sinwar brothers, Muhammad and Yehia, once their leadership is gone and their battalions are gone, we'll still have Hamas, Nikim, we won't have Hamas. As an organization, we'll cease to exist. And then we still have a lot of work to do based on information, to have surgical attacks based on information so Hamas can't regroup and remilitarize. And it will go through a process of West Bankization, where after Operation Defensive Shield in 2002, it took about 2 years in order to really, really end the Second Intifada. And that's the work we have to do. But by the way, after we take down the 6 battalions and their leaders, the intense part of this war will be behind us. And that's not the absolute victory. Absolute victory is a childish term. I'll tell you what it is. It's a good enough victory. It's a fragile victory. It's an imperfect victory. It's a messy victory. It's a good enough victory. But what's the alternative to the good enough victory? The alternative that Hamas gets to October 7th us and stay alive as an organization. That's the alternative. Let's think this through. First of all, it means that Gaza has no future. If Hamas gets as an organization to stay alive, maybe as a governing force in Gaza, and the organization is alive and it gets to start rebuilding itself, Gaza has no future. Because we could all see what's going to happen. Hamas will shoot missiles at Israel. Israel will retaliate. And everything that was rebuilt will be bombed and destroyed. And because people know this in advance, no one will want to rebuild Gaza. No foreign investment will invest anything in Gaza if Hamas is there, because what I said is not highly probable. It's with certainty that everything that will be rebuilt will be destroyed if Hamas is still alive. So stopping this war now and letting Hamas survive means robbing Gaza from its future. There is no rebuilding Gaza if Hamas is alive. But what really troubles Israelis is not only that Gaza has no future if Hamas is alive, after all said and done, as an organization, Israel has no future. And here's why I want to share with you a very probable scenario. What I share with you with Gaza, I think, is with certainty. There is no rebuilding if Gaza, if Hamas is alive. And people that care about the future of Gaza have to understand that Israel has to get this job done. 6 battalions, 3 leaders. It's a messy, but the good enough victory is in sight. No absolute victory, but the good enough victory is in sight. But what will happen to Israel with no good enough victory? So imagine Israelis post the war that we lost. Hamas, October 7th, Hamas is alive. And 2 things happen immediately. The Middle East loses its fear from Israel. Israel doesn't have what it takes to go all the way through. And the Middle East starts bullying Israel. And Israelis lose trust in the process called Israel.
When you're saying the Middle East, of course,
the jihadist forces.
The jihadist forces. And of course, throughout the war, there's been tit for tat altercations in the northern border, which obviously could very easily lead to a war.
100%. So all these forces, okay, so they see, okay, Israel could be, there's going to be a program and you stay alive. Okay, so the Middle East loses its fear from Israel and Israelis lose the trust in the project called Israel. Israel is a country where this could happen and we're not protected. What does that do? It does two things. One, can you imagine the civil war, the cold civil war that will break out in Israel after we lose this war? The blame game would be, and every camp has a credible narrative why why we lost, it's because of the other side, the other team, the other camp. The blame game will be unbearable and it will spiral into a, I hope, only cold civil war. Can you imagine the economic crisis? Which would foreign investment want to invest in a country that is so not safe, that doesn't know how to protect itself? Finally, what will happen is that who will be the first to leave the spiraling down Israel? Who will be the first to leave, obviously?
Those who can be employed elsewhere.
Yeah, the strongest. And then when they leave, things get worse. Israel gets weaker. The blame game gets stronger. The polarization grows. The economic crisis grows. And then the next leave, you can see how this spirals down into a situation where Israel is really weak. And when it's really weak, that's when Iran comes in and finishes it. So this is what we Israelis understand. If there is no victory, there is no survival. When I say victory, I don't mean the absolute victory. I mean the good enough victory. There is no survival. That's quoting Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, when he becomes prime minister in 1940, he says that victory at all costs. Victory at all costs, because he says no matter how long and hard the road may be, if there is no victory, there is no survival. That line of Churchill captures the anxiety and the understanding of Israelis. So let's put this together. If there is no good enough victory, there is no future for Gaza and no future for Israel. So victory at all costs. And the cost is that this war continues. And the war continuing is bad. And people say it's bad. So stop the war.
Israel,
stop the war. The war is bad. That calling, stop the war is bad. It assumes that the alternative is good. Because you're binary thinkers. But we are in a tragedy. The war is bad. The alternative is much, much worse. And that is how we misunderstood. Our need is for the world to understand this is a tragedy with only bad options. And this is not a tragedy that Israel chose. This tragedy was imposed on us on October 7th. We did not choose this. This tragedy was designed by an organization that doesn't only kill civilians, meaning unethical offense, but it also has unethical defense. It hides between and beneath civilians, a combination of unethical offense, October 7th, and unethical defense. That's creating this tragedy, presenting Israel with only bad options. And between these bad options, one option means no future. And that's why we have to avoid it. And that's why Israelis are determined to continue, even though it's messy, anesthetic, bad. And that's the cost of victory. And victory will be achieved at all costs. That is mainstream, not right wing, not left wing. That's how mainstream Israelis are experiencing this. And we feel misunderstood. We feel like people don't see how tragic the situation we are. We're judged as if there are good options that we're not choosing. And if ending the war and giving Hamas a free ride is the good option, all we're asking is, we're not asking you to be sophisticated chess players to see like 12 moves ahead, just two. If Hamas is alive, it means you can't rebuild Gaza. And it means Gaza has no future. Just two, if you really care about Palestinians and you really care about Israel. I mean, some people just, it's all a mask for anti-Semitism. But for the people who are not, the people who really care, all we're asking is look two steps forward, not one.
The pinnacle of this tragedy of bad decisions is, of course, the case of the hostages. And there's no one in Israel who doesn't want them to come home. But the idea of victory at all costs is also extremely worrying when Hamas is the one who is holding the cards in any kind of hostage release deal. And so the question is, when Israel goes into Rafah, where there are four more battalions, and where we think that many of the hostages are we willing to pay this price as well? Is this victory at all costs?
I think this imperfect, good enough victory, I don't think it could be an immediate victory. It can't be. I think victory is in sight. We can see it. But I think that most Israelis want to deal, even if it means that we're delaying the good enough victory. We're willing to go for the long and hard journey. These hostages are our brothers and our sisters. And that's an Israeli told me just a while ago, they are in the Shoah now, not in 1945. There's Jews, and not only Jews, Israelis from all parts of Israeli society.
Not only Israelis.
And not only Israelis. They are in the Shoah now as we're talking. My wife sometimes wakes up in the middle of the night and she had a bad dream and she was there in the tunnels with them. I'm sharing this story not because she's unique. She is unique in many ways, but this is not a unique story. So many Israelis, that's how they feel. They're in there in the tunnels with them. And that is why Israelis are willing to do a lot and pay a lot to get them out. Here's my best formulation, I think, of where most Israelis are. What I'll share with you now, Amanda, is not based on any poll. We can't do polls now because we don't know what the deal really is. What are the details of the deal? So what I'm saying is now is very abstract. But if the deal means that Israel takes out of prison many terrorists, some of them serious terrorists, and we would like all these terrorists just to go to Gaza, but that might not be the deal. They might be located in different, they're free to go in different places within Israel. That's very dangerous. And it will, with high probability, lead to terrorist attacks, and this will risk our security. With high probability, we just know this because this is what happened last time with the Shalit deal, right? I don't know if there's anything worse than Yichya Sinwar, but like these are very, this, we're taking a risk. But here's the thing, Amanda. Israelis are willing to do this. Israelis are willing to risk their security if it means the liberty of the hostages. Our security for their liberty, that's the deal we're willing to do. That's the level of solidarity that Israelis get to have. We're willing to risk our security for their liberty. But I'll tell you what Israelis are not willing to do. If a deal means stopping the war or doing things which de facto will lead with high probability to the end of the war, which means Hamas has a free ride, which means no future for Gaza or what we care about for Israel, I think that's something that Israelis will not agree to. So my best formulation, Israelis are willing to, in order to liberate the hostages, our brothers and sisters, they are willing to risk Israelis to liberate the hostages. They're not willing to risk Israel in order to liberate those hostages. I think that captures the spirit of mainstream Israelis.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
There are different visions of what Israel is. And prior to the war, of course, we've discussed several of them. And we went through 9 months, the full pregnancy of judicial overhaul protest. This week, the protests have come back in many ways, though with slightly different colors. In Jerusalem this week, there have been 4 days of massive protests outside the Knesset, ostensibly about the hostages, ostensibly about calling for new elections. But what we're seeing is, if you were just to take the pictures from the previous summer and put them side by side to the pictures that we're seeing today, tent city, all sorts of flags, water cannons, all sorts of the same trappings, history is repeating itself today.
I'm not sure it is. I'm not sure it is. It's all very early. I want to offer a different assessment. So the truth is, I wrote a book about this that came out. It's in Hebrew. It's in Hebrew. It's not in English. It probably will come out in English later on. It's called Hayom HaShmini, the eighth day.
First of all, before you start about anything, I just don't understand the title. So explain the title.
The eighth day, October 7th, right? And now we're talking about the day after. It's also a pun in Hebrew because a Yom HaShmini has biblical meaning, and it's always also in Shmini Atzeret. It's a triple quadruple pun. It's the great idea of my editor, Shmuel Rosner. It's his idea. It's his name. It's a very powerful name, HaYom HaShmini. And in the second part of my book, there is a poll that tries to offer a capture a deeper understanding of how Israel really is divided and is polarized. Now, you've mentioned the nine months of our vicious argument about judicial reform or overhaul. And that argument turned into a fight, which turned into a cold civil war. It made us very weak. Our enemies detected our weakness, and some of them decided to hit us.
Just to mention as well, in this 9 months, one of the factors of making us appear weak was the elite reservists, the pilots, saying that they would not continue to show up to serve. And so it was an objective weakness in many ways on the part of Israel's ability to deter.
And so Israel looked very, very, yes, I think our enemies had a hard time to understand how resilient it is and how unified we'll be if they attack us, or at least the people in Gaza. But our internal fight weakened us, and our weakness invited our enemies inside. Any tourist coming to Israel during those 9 months, and many Israelis touring around Israel, would probably be a victim of the following optical illusion. We were all victims of an optical illusion that looks like this. Israel is divided into two camps, two political tribes that hate each other because their value system is so different that they are determined to clash. One tribe is the democratic Israel. The other tribe is the Jewish Israel. One tribe is the liberal Israel. The other tribe is the conservative Israel. One tribe is the Tel Aviv Israel. The other tribe is the Jerusalem Israel. One is secular, one is religious. And it's so easy for us to divide Israel into two, by the way, because we're binary thinkers. Because our mind is always seduced. By the way, natural selection designed our minds in order the binary button is so easily, it's so easy to press on it. And by the way, algorithms only weaponize our binary thinking, and it's very hard to escape it. But actually, Israel, it's an optical illusion that we're divided into two, because Israel is actually divided into three. And according to a very serious poll that I use in my book, this is how Israel really looks like. Try to measure the level of liberalism of Israelis and the level of nationalism of Israelis. Okay? We'll try to measure how Israelis are, the relationship between Israelis and these two values. And you would find that there is many Israelis, I mean, not many Israelis, there's a group of Israelis that rank very high on nationalism, very low on liberalism. I call them homogeneous Israelis. They have one main value that populates their world, their consciousness. And they're in the far right. Homogeneous Israelis, only national, not liberal. In the far left, there's a small group, it's even a smaller group than the one on the far right, that scores very high on liberalism and very low on nationalism. They always feel like nationalism is fascism, and it's a threat to human rights and human liberties, and it's a threat to the purity of liberalism. By the way, just like the people on the far right feel like liberalism is a stain on nationalism, it makes us weak nationalism. And these are homogeneous groups of Israelis. The only liberalism on the left, the only nationalism on the far right. But most Israelis score very high on nationalism and very high on liberalism.
It has always been a conundrum to me. For example, in the IDF supports homosexuals, and there's an open policy, and there's no don't ask, don't tell. We as a secular society support homosexual partnerships. Just taking one very liberal idea, for example.
The largest group in Israel is the hybrid group of Israelis. Liberal nationalists. Now, in the heart of liberalism is individualism. We have our rights, our liberties, our dreams, and we'll pursue it, like Frank Sinatra said, my way, and don't tell me what to do.
And support others to do it
And support
their
others
way.
To do it their way. Yeah. That's such an important part of mainstream Israelis. And behind nationalism, we have collectivism. Collectivism means that you feel like you belong to a story that's bigger than your own. You belong to a group, and you'll bring the sacrifice for that group. Now, as Jonathan Haidt writes, Western people have a problem. They are so individualistic, they lost the ability to be connected to something bigger than themselves, or the group that's bigger than themselves. Usually when you're a hyper-individualist, you're not a collectivist. And vice versa. And like communism, fascism, fundamentalism, where you are like an organic part, there's a story, you're an organic part of your collective, your own individual rights don't matter, and your own individual dreams, forget about them. Israelis are hybrid. They're individualists and collectivists. I could be an entrepreneur in Tel Aviv with my liberty and autonomy and dreams and pursue them, and I'll do it my way, competing with some other ambitious individualist that is doing it his way or her way, and then October 7th happened, and you forget everything, and you're 120 days in Chan Yunis in service of the collective. Who could pull that off? That is hybrid Israelis. And that is, by the way, hybrid Israelis are the Israelis that embody and internalize the hybrid formula of the state of Israel as documented in our founding document, the Declaration of Independence. Israel is a Jewish democracy. The word democracy is not there in the Declaration of Independence, but the idea that every individual has rights that need to be protected, and they weren't given, individuals don't have rights, they weren't given to us by the government, and therefore they can't be taken away from us by the government. That liberal idea is canonized in the founding document of Israel, and that Israel is the Jewish state, the nation state of the Jewish people. And we have a story that starts in the Bible, and we're all a part of this national, grand, historic project that's also part of the DNA of the Jewish state. So we are a Jewish democracy. That's a hybrid formula. Hybrid Israelis are national liberals. Those are the majority of Israelis. And here's the challenge of hybrid Israelis. It's the largest group, and it doesn't know it's a group. It's a group that doesn't know that it's a group. And my argument is like this. Israel seems like it's divided into two, while it's actually divided into three. It's not Jewish Israel versus democratic Israel. It's in the far right, there's Jewish Israel. In the far left, democratic Israel. And in the center, the Jewish democratic Israel. Israel is not extremist on the right, extremist on the left, but moderates in the center. No, it's homogeneous Israelis on the far right, homogeneous Israelis on the far left, and hybrids in the center. The fact that hybrids are also moderate, being moderate is a byproduct of being hybrid. Because every value I have balances and softens the other one. The fact that the homogeneous Israelis are so extremes because they have only one value that's not balanced by other values. Now, the problem of hybrid Israelis is the following. It's a group with no group awareness. It's a group that doesn't know it's a group. And our tragedy, I'm using that word again, is that hybrid Israelis have a tendency to be divided between themselves. And here's how it works. So this group of Israelis, which share the same values, hybrid values, nationalism and liberalism, they don't share the same proportions. Some of them are both national and liberal, but a little bit more liberal than national. Some are a little bit more national than liberal. That's fine. They could work it out. They could compromise. They can become a group. But here's the problem. What happens when the Israelis are a little bit more national than liberal are seduced to become allies of the people on the far right, which are only national and not liberal?
So that sounds like our political map after
exactly
five elections in which the hybrid middles couldn't get it together
exactly
to put together.
Exactly. Also, in the 90s, people that were more liberal than national became allies of the only liberal, not national. So when the people are seduced, the hybrid Israelis, to become allies of the people that are homogeneous, hybrid Israelis are split among themselves, and Israel is divided into two, and we become victims of this optical, the optical illusion becomes a reality. Here's where this war has a lot of potential. Hybrid Israelis are finding themselves. First of all, they're finding the power of hybrid ideology. How the combination of collectivism alone means that our own individual talents and creativity and dreams are choked and suffocated, and they don't become part of the strength of Israel. So it weakens the collective. Collectivism weakens the collective. But also individualism weakens the collective. Of course, if people only care about themselves and not about the collective, this combination of collectivism and individualism is creating the strength that we see in our military now.
I'm glad you mentioned the military, because in many ways, everything you're talking about, this individualism and collectivism, is kind of balanced out in the army, as I'm seeing through my kids who are now, two are in the army, a third will join in 2 weeks. What I'm seeing is that the army has some kind of special sauce in creating a group out of disparate, different people.
Exactly. Exactly. The army is turning hybrid Israelis into Israelis that realized that we're closer to each other than we are to the people on the fringes, to the extremes. And this is the opportunity this war is creating, because we're also seeing the strength that comes from being hybrid. And also, hybrid Israelis are bonding throughout this war. You see, when 350,000 Israelis are recruited to reserves, that's where hybrid Israelis that were told for 9 months that they belong to different groups, they meet, they bond, and guess what they realize? They're so close to each other. And the optical illusion loses its power. It loses its spell over our minds. Which, now, right now, our politics represents, the politics of 6th of October is Israel divided into two. Will the politics of the 8th day, of post-October 7th, means that Israel is divided into two and the hybrid group of the middle is the group that leads Israel? That, Amanda, is one of the greatest opportunities of this moment in our history.
So, of course, we're talking about those who are serving and the army as a way to create this unified collective of the hybrid Israelis. And just to mention, we're not talking about only Jews, of course, serving with my son, Druze, yeah, and all sorts of different kinds of Israelis. But there's one kind of Israeli that is definitely not serving with either my son or my daughter, and that is the Haredi Israeli. Mm-hmm. And right now, of course, this is obviously in the news as the resolution that gave the government until March 31st to not draft the Haredim has finished. And the High Court of Justice has said that no more funding will be given to the yeshivot, to the yeshiva pupils, some almost 60,000 of which are eligible to draft right now. We are at a precipice. We are at a turning point. And do you see, Micha, that this draft, this potential draft of the Haredim could get them into this army in which they would turn into some kind of hybrid Israeli, and then maybe all of our social fabric will be sewn up again and everything will be great?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible that it will take time for thousands of ultra-Orthodox Israelis to join the military and to the military to socialize into Israel itself. I think it's possible. I think it was Amos Oz said once that the last big aliyah, big wave of immigration, came from Russia. The next one will be from Bnei Brak. And we have to promote the next big aliyah from the state of from the land of Israel into the state of Israel, into Israeliness, as my friend Benny Lau put it once. But I don't think that's the story here. I don't think the story is that we might get a few hundred or thousand Haredim to join the army. I think the argument itself has positive unintended consequences. Here's one of our take. Throughout the history of Israel, we're always having many, many arguments. Like in America, simultaneously you have arguments about guns, about abortion, about national security issues, about taxes, about Israel. Many, many arguments. But there's one argument that sometimes has all the gravity, that becomes the main argument, that draws the dividing lines. And Israel is the same. In Israel, the first generation of Israeli political argument, I think Israel has three generations of arguments. Generation number one was about the vision of socialism that Ben-Gurion had. And it was challenged by the Tzionim HaKlaliim, like a capitalist party, and by Menachem Begin from a different. In the first 20 years of Israel, we were debating big government, small government, socialism, capitalism. And in an Israeli way, it has its own unique Israeli flavor. That was the first 20 years. Then Six-Day War happens. And as a result of the Six-Day War, a new argument replaced the old argument. And instead of arguing about the size of the government, we would start arguing about the size of the country. What do we do with the land that was occupied, liberated, choose your word, in the Six-Day War? Do we settle it? Do we trade it for peace? That became a very big argument. And the old argument about the size of the government, about taxation, about privatization, that became a very peripheral argument. It lost its gravity. The dividing lines were not about, are you for capitalism or socialism, but what do you think about land and peace? That argument starts dying in the 21st century. It loses its energy. It loses its energy partially because If you look at Israelis today, as we're talking, the two-state solution, some Israelis support it, some don't support it. But the people who do support it, let's say Yesh Atid voters, they say, I'm for a two-state solution, but it could only be implemented like after the Palestinians go through de-radicalization and after they have a state that protects human rights, that recognizes the existence of Israel. They have to, it's all these. So you ask a Yesh Atid voter, when will that happen? I'll say, maybe, I don't know.
Yes, but.
Maybe 30 years from now, 40 years from now. By the way, so you ask Likud voters, are you for annexation? Yes, but we have to have the diplomatic and the demographic and the economic conditions. When will the conditions be ready for like annexation of the of Area A in the West Bank and Judea and Samaria? Maybe 30, 40 years. What happens when an argument, when we're arguing about, we used to argue about what's going to happen tomorrow morning. Now Israelis are arguing about what will happen 40 years from now. Now, when the argument moves from the present to the future, the meaning of the argument changes.
But it's actually a really healthy sign in a way that we think there will be Israel in 40 years.
That's right. There will be. I think there will. I think there will be a resilient Israel in 40 years. But it's true. We're thinking about that like 40 years from now. And when we think about that, so when I say I'm for a two-state solution, but in 40 years, what am I actually saying? I'm speaking less about a policy we need to promote. And I'm signaling my political identity. I belong to the left or to the center left. When I say I'm for annexation 40 years from now, it's not a policy statement. It's an identity statement. So what are the policy issues that could divide hybrid Israelis between themselves? It's not big government, small government anymore. It's not big country, small country anymore. So what are the issues that could divide hybrid Israelis? My argument is there's not many issues left that could divide hybrid Israelis, which means this might be the moment where hybrid Israelis unite. And then the ultra-Orthodox argument becomes dominant. Now, it seems like this argument, which was always there, but is moving its way from the periphery of the Israeli conversation to the center of the Israeli conversation. And it might create the new dividing lines. Amanda, the old conversations, the old disagreements divided hybrid Israelis. This is a disagreement that unites hybrid Israelis. If the new dividing lines won't be between, what will be not about land or peace, capitalism or socialism, but between the population that serves, the population that doesn't serve, that's an argument that creates group awareness for hybrid Israelis. Group awareness is the missing component of this group. That's why one of the unintended consequences of this argument becoming so dominant is it enhances the process that a new group awareness, a new group is emerging out of this war. This is the group that if it leads Israel, I think it could lead to the rebirth of Israel.
It's so true that this argument contains so many different elements of many different arguments. So for example, as I said, the High Court of Justice ruled that funding will stop for the yeshivot because the government couldn't get it together and legislate a law that was considered equitable enough to be ratified. And so we still have this judicial overhaul argument as well.
Yes, but Amanda, also the judicial overhaul is an optical illusion. In the heat of the judicial overhaul debate in Israel, where we felt Israel is divided into two camps, the camp of democracy and the camp of, they also call themselves camp of democracy, like two different understandings of democracy. So serious polling was done. And you know what it turns out? Only 20% or less of the people in the far right wanted to implement the radical reform of Yariv Levin. And less than 20% on the far left were against any reform. And roughly 57% of Israelis were for a reform, just not this reform, more balanced, more moderate, more gradual, and based on a larger consensus. So even in the hype of the debate over the judicial reform or overhaul, when it seems like Israel was divided into two, it was actually divided into three. The no compromises camps on the right and the left, and a large compromise camp in the center. And that's the camp that wasn't heard. It's the majority of Israelis with a minority of the voice. Can hybrid Israelis find their voice? This war is creating the promise. It's creating the opportunity that hybrid Israelis develop develop group awareness. That's what my book is trying to do. The argument with the Haredim is in service of this. So in the end of this argument, will Haredim join hybrid Israelis? Maybe, halivai. But will the argument itself create the awareness for hybrid Israelis? I think it could. I think it has the power to do that. And that is a part of the promise of this moment, of Israel being divided into three and having hybrid Israelis, which hold within them the secret sauce of Israel, the superpower of Israel, the ability to be both individualistic and collectivistic, hybrid Israelis, to give them the keys to lead Israel and to lead, I think. You asked before, in 40 years from now, will Israel exist? It's a scary time. It's a scary moment. And many people feel like this is like the second war of independence. And I want to just go into that metaphor. The second war of, when Israelis speak about the second war of independence, I ask them, what do you mean? And some say, well, in the war of independence, our existence was on the line. And again, our existence is on the line. I see that. But we have to admit, the level of the existential risk in 48 was much larger than it is today. Before David Ben-Gurion declared the state of Israel, he knew that Arab armies will invade Israel once he does that and will have a serious war. And he was debating. And he asked his general, Yadin, what are chances of winning this war? Yadin answers, what does he answer?
50-50.
50-50. And Ben-Gurion, 50-50, 50 we win, 50 we lose. Let's do it. Let's go for it. Let's roll the dice. Creating Israel was a strategic gamble. By the way, now we know. What would happen if we would have landed on the wrong 50? I think now we know how that looks like.
I think neither of us would be here.
Neither of us. We wouldn't have had it. Are we in a 50-50 moment today? I don't think so. Israel is much stronger. America is still with Israel. Israel still has a lot of moves it didn't do yet. I don't think, maybe we're 95-5, maybe 90-10. It's still kind of scary, but we're not 50-50. Some people say we're in the second war of independence because after the first war of independence, Israelis, when the war was over, they went to work and they created Israel. Amanda, we're both Israelis, so we know that that sense exists in Israel. So many Israelis feel things are broken. When this war is over, we'll have to rebuild Israel all over again. If we have a good enough victory and restore the trust of Israelis in Israel and the fear of the Middle East from Israel, I think what we'll see is Israelis rebuilding Israel. So the way I capture this, we are in the second war of independence, but not because of the size of the risk, but because of the size of the opportunity. After the first war Israel was built, maybe there might be an opportunity of a new leading group to emerge from this war, hybrid Israelis. And maybe the opportunity of this moment is that Israel can be created all over again when this is over.
Michal, the world awaits your book in English as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for listening to What Matters Now, the Times of Israel's weekly in-depth discussion. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode of What Matters Now, please send an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. I'm Amanda Borchel-Dan. Shalom.